And I'd like to welcome tonight's moderator, Glenda Carpio, to introduce Professors Callahan and Bradley. A professor of African and African-American Studies and English at Harvard, Professor Carpio is the author of Laughing Fit to Kill, Black Humor and the Fictions of Slavery. So please join me in welcoming her.
Well, thank you all for coming, especially our authors. To say that this big mammoth thing has been highly anticipated is completely the biggest understatement I think I could make. But I won't go into that right now. What I will say is that one of the people who was anticipating this event wrote a very thoughtful piece in the Washington Post in 2007. That's Will Haywood, who started an article saying when Ralph Ellison died in 1994, he left four decades worth of scribble notes, thousands of typed pages, and 80 computer disks filled with work on an ambitious second novel, right? That's the plot that we have here, right? For 14 years, a pair of literary detectives, to my right and my left, labored to fit the pieces together, and now they're ready to share it with the world, right? So I'm here to introduce both of them, and then I'll say just some brief remarks as introducing the project from my perspective. Okay, so to my right, I have Professor John Callahan, who's Ellison's literary executor, and the Morgan S. Odell Professor of Humanities at Lewis and Clark College. He's the author, among many other titles, of In the American Grain, The Pursuit of Voice in 20th Century Black Fiction, which came out in 1988, and In Juneteenth, which was a portion of the novel that we are here gathered to talk about, which was published in 1999. Obviously, I'm leaving out a whole host of other things he's published in the interest of time. Okay. To my left, I have Adam Bradley, who was Professor Callahan's former student at Lewis and Clark. He's a graduate of Harvard University's English Department, where he finished his PhD in 2003. He's also a friend and now an associate professor at the University of Colorado at Boulder. He's the author of Book of Rhymes, The Poetics of Hip Hop, which came out in 2009, and the forthcoming Ralph Ellison in Progress, From Invisible Man to 3 Days Before the Shooting, out this year, right? Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I very much liked about the Washington Post piece with which I started is that it highlights some of the interlocking stories that this novel brings to the foreground, right? First, Ellison's quest to write a second novel after the smashing success of its masterpiece, Invisible Man, which came out in 1952, and how an author lives with the second, almost a curse, right? How do you come up with a second act? Then the other story is a story of our literary detectives who sift through the 27 archival boxes worth of pages for the second novel, including handwritten notes, typewritten pages, over 460 computer files on 84 disks, right? How do you look at that, right? And make cohesive sense out of it. Then the story of fathers and sons who are estranged from each other. Callahan's relationship to Ellison is a father-son relationship in many ways. Then we have Adam and his own father, and the ways in which these stories of fathers and sons who are estranged from each other, who find each other, actually really connects with the content of the novel, which has to do with two characters. Adam... The character's name Adam, as if Ellison knew somehow. Adam Sunrader, who passes for white and becomes a race-baiting senator, sort of like a black-white supremacist in the Black No More tradition or the Dave Chappelle tradition, right? And Alonzo Hickman, the black preacher who, unknown to the world at large, has raised Sunrader as a son. The novel centers upon the connection, estrangement, and reconciliation of these two characters, right? And then for me, the other relationship that comes into, like, interlocking relationship is also the relationship between Professor Callahan and Professor Bradley, right? A teacher, a student, now collaborators, co-authors in many ways. So these four major strands very interesting for me. Happy to talk about that later. Okay. So very briefly, background, I'm sure you, our authors will talk about this too. In 1999, Professor Callahan published portions of this novel, and it's the I bring it up again because the reception of the novel was very mixed, right? Some people were very happy to finally have this long-awaited piece of this long-awaited novel, right? Not that Professor Callahan had also published some of Ellison's short stories and some of his essays in the meantime, right after his death in 1994, 1995, some of these stories and essays come out. But when he published Juneteenth in 1999, he got mixed reviews. Right? Some people, the New York Times, for instance, you know, this is like also evaluations from students, no matter if you get like 10,000 great evaluations, the one that's bad sticks with you, right? So the New York Times, I think the most pungent one was the New York Times wrote, the book provides the reader with intimations of the grand vision animating Ellison's 40-year project, but it also feels disappointingly provisional and incomplete, right? Instead, and the quote goes on, instead of the symphonic work Ellison envisioned, Callahan has given us a single tentatively rendered melodic line. Instead of a vast modernist epic about the black experience in America, he has given us a flawed linear novel focused around one man's emotional and political evolution. Right. So now, many years later, we have the work of, you know, this co-author work in which we actually do get the symphony. Right. Professor Callahan, in many ways, learned from what happened in Juneteenth, and I'm eager to hear how they feel about the fact that this book is finally out and some of the challenges that the work presented. The book includes many editorial notes that are not intrusive, that kept to a minimum. And I wonder, for me, I'm very curious to know how they struck the balance between wanting to edit and present guiding editorial work and letting Ellison finally have his say in his second novel. So please help me in welcoming our authors and hearing what they have to say about this incredible work. All right.
Do you want to start?
Yeah, you go ahead.
Okay. Well, this is my old stomping grounds. Ellison, as Glenda just mentioned, spent some 40 years working on this book. But the other story are the years that John and I have spent, some 15. But just like Ellison didn't write every single day of those 40 years, we didn't work every single day of those 15. We did a lot of things in between, some of which Glenda alluded to. For me, one of the things I did was to come here and get my PhD in English, to become a professor myself, to join John Callahan in the ranks of literary scholars and to come together on this project. I also got to witness the kind of display in 1999 of the response to Juneteenth. And it was a striking thing for me, particularly given the fact that Juneteenth, by its own admission and description, was intended to be simply one line of a broader symphony. This was explicitly what John put out in Juneteenth as the idea for the book, and there was always the plan for what we have here, the symphony that is. So I thought those critiques were just so short-sighted in their vision. And one thing that I can say, and we'll have a lot more to say, I'm sure, as the evening goes on, but one thing I can say about 3 days and its effect is that, to me at least, it puts Juneteenth in another kind of light that is actually quite valuable, because it shows that for whatever else, other thousands of pages that Ellison wrote, that Juneteenth still has a central place in this symphony of Ellison's composition, in the literary symphony that he was working on for these 40 years. And to me, it bears out the judgment that John made in those years. So we can have them both, and that's the wonderful thing about a work of unfinished literary vision like this, is that we can live with both of them, and we don't have to make the decisions. This provisional nature of the work actually invites us to have an occasion for participation in the creation of the fiction as readers, to get into the mind of this author. Such a rare opportunity, certainly with an author of this stature, to be able to see the sorts of decisions that he made, the sorts of roads that he took and then turned around and came back on. All of these sorts of things are present within this volume and are really, the greatest gift that 3 Days offers for Ellison's readers. So I just wanted to say that and maybe pass it over to John.
Well, thank you, Adam. I mean, it's so much better to have someone else who's intimately acquainted with what we're talking about make the case than I have to make it. I would say one thing parenthetically, because my friend, sometimes sparring partner, old-time colleague, and chiefly friend, Henry Louis Gates Jr. isn't here. I didn't see Officer Crowley either. I kind of hoped that we might have him. If Glenda didn't show up, I was going to call the Cambridge Police Department and say, we got a serious emergency over here. We need Crowley to come in. And we may need him yet. I don't know how things will go as the evening goes on. But in any case, I would much... Skip Gates wrote a really, I think, a wonderful piece. It's an essay for Time magazine in 1999 when Juneteenth came out, and I would commend that to you. I mean, I don't want to pretend that I'm Barack Obama and have to deal with the New York Times. I don't really have to do that. I hope he doesn't have to do it and just ignores the damn stuff. And some of it is so. Uninformed, but Adam is right on. I mean, the what we have here, and it was always kind of intentions grow along the way, and what we really are trying to do is as Adam outlined it, and it's something that I think is Adam was very he had the right instincts and the right intuitions, and he had the capacity to carry them out. I think we both tried to do that in this book, and that is to give Ellison's readers are a special breed, pretty intelligent folks, pretty stubborn, defiant folks in their own right. So we say here's Juneteenth, and this is what it is. It's a fragment. It's a narrative, and it's a narrative that that did undergo some editing. In the full sense of the word. Now, every word is Ellison's, but the sequences, I made some decisions, some judgments about the sequences, that is, sharp readers of this volume will see the sequences in which the episodes of are presented in Book 2 sometimes differ from the sequences of Juneteenth, and that's because I gave more, I gave more weight and heft to certain of Ellison's notes and outlines, which Adam has seen, no one else has, Adam's seen them, about the action of the story and how the action would go. But our intention here is, as Glenda said as well, is to offer what Ellison did to his readers. So that's why you will. You know, we had interesting go-around. Poor Adam and poor me. We got the copy-edited manuscript of the novel back from Random House, from the Modern Library, and Adam and I, it wasn't that we sat down in a couple of weeks and said, here it is. We worked on this for years, on and off, and very intensely in the last year and a half or so, 2 years really. And so we sent it off to the Modern Library, and the editor. I don't know how intensely our editor worked on it. It was fairly quickly. It was farmed out to a copy editor who sent it back to us, and every page, I mean, there were, unbelievable numbers of corrections. You couldn't count them all. And I never thought I'd write Stet, let it stand, in other words, as many times as I did in this manuscript. And Adam and I conferred about it, and there were a number of things. It was as if the copy editor had took the position, whether consciously or not, that maybe Adam had written the book or I had written the book. We'd never written any fiction, and here it is, and it promising stuff, and so it deserved the toughest, most rigorous copy editing that could exist. And there's Charles Davidson. How are you, Charles? Good to see you. Anyway, there was no sense of the context. This is a posthumous novel. And so Adam and I had to go through and made the judgment that that finally we were not going to edit this. I mean, if there was something missing, something egregiously ungrammatical, we would attend to it. Errors of spelling, we would attend to. But Ellison liked to start sentences with "and," at times enormously effectively. But sometimes, particularly in the computer printouts, I think there was one case, Adam, where he started five sentences in a row with "and."
At least, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And the copy editor, you know, wanted to change every one except the first one. Well, we had to go through and stat. No, I mean, this is the way Ralph wrote it. And what we're trying to do, really, is to take the narratives, both the typescripts and the computer printouts, to say, what are the chief narratives that Ralph was writing? There were really four, books one and two in typescript. The first book one, narrated by the white reporter, Wellborn McIntyre. Book two is kind of antiphonal, multi-voiced. It's a book that owes a great deal to the modernist tradition, and a great deal simultaneously, as was Ellison's wont, to the black church, to the black oral tradition. And that Juneteenth is basically that book, and so neither one. Book one is seems finished in plot and structure, but it's stylistically rough and less polished in book two, which clearly isn't finished. Ellison breaks it off at the end. He hadn't quite found a way to knit these together. And then we have the computer, and then there's another crucial episode called a 40-page manuscript called Bliss's Birth, which Ellison always intended to put into book two. But we present it here. He hadn't quite decided finally where to put it, as he hadn't quite finally decided many, many things. Okay, cut to part two, the computer, the narratives that Ellison created on the computer from 1982, and the last date we have that's absolutely and solidly reliable is December 30th, 1993. When curiously he writes that he takes chapter 12 of book one, where McIntyre, the white reporter, goes to the townhouse of this 95-year-old black guy named Jesse Rockmore, who's been found dead, dead in a coffin. In his townhouse, and foul play is suspected. The reporter goes over there, and Hickman will go over there as well. Anyway, Ellison, on December 30th, 1993, the last date we have with any certitude, Ellison revises it. I shouldn't say rewrites it. And it's clear that most of the changes are word here, a phrase there, an emphasis there. And it was clear that he must have had before him Chapter 12 of Book 1, because that's where McIntyre goes to Jesse's, and you have a whole lot of that. Okay, so what you have then is a provisional quality to this manuscript, to these fragments. They are interrelated, interlocking, interconnected, but the locks aren't really tied down. The interlocking isn't complete. Ellison didn't make certain crucial structural decisions about how this material was going to work together. What he did instead, almost, I won't say instead, but, well, he didn't do that, and what he did do instead, what perhaps, was to take off, to create new characters, new episodes, or to pick up old characters and take them to a different place. He was very much involved, as you said, suggest, Adam. He didn't have writer's block. If anything, he wrote, you might argue that he wrote too much. He wrote so much that it got, as he continued to write, it got more and more difficult for him to do the absolute rigorous revision and structural changes that he had to do. And I'm going to stop there, and lest I go on too much, go back to Adam. You may want to comment on some of these particulars of the novel. We'll go back and forth as much.
Yeah, and one thing to think about in kind of coming to terms with what he left behind, I think of it in terms of a musical analogy. Take a great album from Miles Davis, take Seven Steps to Heaven, take Kind of Blue, whatever you want. And imagine knowing that album so well, you know, backwards and forwards, you know, every single turn of phrase, every single orchestration. And then imagine hearing the complete Columbia box set of all the studio versions, where you have outtakes and you know, riffs and so on and so forth. Hearing him play the same songs over years, a jazz standard reinterpreted for a different setting, whether it's played live or in the studio, whether it's played with a quartet or a quintet or a septet or whatever it may be. This is maybe one way of getting a handle on what Ellison was up to. The modulations of voice across these 40 years are tremendous. And in many ways, it echoed the equipment he was using. I mean, this may sound like a silly point, but he began working on this novel around the time that Invisible Man was coming to publication in the 50s, early 50s. And he started jotting down ideas for this second novel based upon a character in the first, based upon a character that some of you may remember from Invisible Man named Reinhardt. And Reinhardt, you see, is a character with a hidden name, B.P. Reinhardt. The full name is only mentioned once, Bliss Proteus Reinhardt. Well, Bliss would take on a new life in the second novel. Bliss is the name that Hickman gives to the child of indeterminate race whom he becomes a surrogate father for over the years. It's the child that becomes Sun Raider, the senator that Glenda was talking about, so central to the plot. He's doing this in a small notebook, one of those modeled black and white composition books. From there, he moves to a typewriter, electric typewriter. And finally, in 1981, a laptop computer, the very early laptop. This thing was 25-pound laptop, 4-inch green screen monitor. I mean, can you imagine trying to write a literary masterpiece on a piece of equipment like that, as intractable as that? And yet he bent it to his will. One of the great joys of my life was as a 19-year-old student, and John, I still marvel at this, that he let me do this, but John, when he got all these boxes of materials, he said, you know, Adam, I'm working on a lot of things. We have the collected essays of Ralph Ellison coming out from the Modern Library, but if you have a little time and you want to go through these boxes of Ellison's second novel, go ahead and get started. So as a 19-year-old kid, I sat there looking at these pages that you know, maybe three people had seen. Ellison himself, Fanny Ellison, his wife, perhaps John, maybe not even John sometimes, and reading these things. And of course I was astounded and I was humbled, but I felt an unexpected response that really snuck up on me and that actually ended up being more important than any of those. And it was the kind of shock at a particular moment. And what it was, I was reading one of these drafts and I saw something I never thought I would see in the work of a literary master. I saw a typo. And I kept reading, I saw more typos. I saw sentences that were rough, that needed some tailoring, that needed honing and working. I saw sentences that just didn't seem, even for my young standards, up to the standards that he should be at. And yet, for all of that, I saw the subsequent drafts. I saw him honing the sentence, working it to perfection, and moving it toward the kind of prose that we are familiar with from this literary giant. That was such a profound moment of realization. I mean, there's only so much that great teachers can do in the classroom. They can do a lot, but there was something about actually seeing that really changed the course of my own career personally. And I think also made me have a perspective as to why this particular edition can be so valuable as a reader's edition, not just for scholars, as we initially thought, but really as for readers in the most general possible way. And it's this. A reader can pick up this book and read for 300, 400 pages uninterrupted in the flow of Ellison's narrative. Sometimes, you know, some of his finest prose. Finer than anything on the level of the sentence that he ever wrote in Invisible Man. And yet you can also go into the book and find those sentences that I saw. We took care of the typos, but some of the sentences that show him still working on the level of the line, still playing with possibilities in language. Take, for instance, the opening of the prolog, you know, 3 days before the shooting, a plane load of Southern Negroes, on and on and on. In the 1990s, he runs that through nearly a dozen different iterations, moving from Southern Negroes to blacks to African Americans to Afro-Americans to every possible, you know, iteration of that term. And in working that, not only speaking about revision, but also speaking about a broader understanding of where black Americans are over the years in which he's composing this book. This began around the time of Brown v. Board of Education. And he wrote it through the Civil Rights Movement. He wrote it through the Black Power Movement, through Vietnam, through the Women's Liberation Movement, through the birth of the digital age. He wrote it through all of that, and he saw the transformations of America and tried to reflect them in his novel, even as he kept to the same putative time period of 1955. This is a wild idea, to write a novel so squarely set in the Civil Rights Movement, yet also expanding to encompass really the entirety of the second half of the 20th century. And so for that reason, yeah, it's a big feat. And it's, so that reason, even though it's in a lot of ways, he failed of this grand ambition in the attempt. there's so much, even in the attempt to do this kind of work, that I think this novel, and we can call it a novel, even though it is a series of manuscripts, this novel, consistent in its vision over all of these years, really has, I think, an important place in the 21st century as we come to terms still with these dogged questions about race and nation and the promise of a multiracial American democracy. These were what Ellison was dedicated to, these themes, and these themes are what are embodied in this book at its best.
One of the things, if I could jump in for a second, is that, you know, if you call Ellison postmodernist, he might wince and look at you like you're some weirdo, right? But I think one of the things that inadvertently happens is that this novel raises really central postmodern questions, like what is an author? What is a text? What do you call a novel, right? Is it a series of, you know, when you take off the, you see behind the scenes, you see the seams, you see the author working, not the finished product, but the process too. So I think it raises, like you said, 21st century questions, not only in terms of content, but also in terms of form, right? Even in its look, it looks like Underworld, it looks like Gravity's Rainbow, it looks like Infinite Jest. It reads like that too in many ways. So I just wanted to put that out there too, and looking forward to some questions.
I think
that you were about to say.
Yeah, I think that's a good jumping off point, Glenda, from what I'd like to say, especially mention of the 20th century. I guess I might as well add my 2 cents to that context, but I'm going to do it in particular in relation to Invisible Man. I mean, I came to believe that, and still do, that it's a stroke of genius to write that first sentence, "I am an invisible man," and to carry that out, that metaphor out over the whole of the novel. And I came to believe, as I still do, but that this was an amazing metaphor for the human self, for absolutely rooted with a kind of utterly necessary specificity in the African American connect in the African American context, and because of that incredible specificity, it radiates out to everybody. Every human being living in the 20th century, particularly the second half of the 20th century, seems a wonderful metaphor for contingency and terror and possibility, all those things that every individual human being has to come to terms with. And I thought, but I realized lately, and for a particular reason, why that perception of mine fell short. Because I said the 20th century, and it seems to me that metaphor, invisibility, is one that we're dealing with right now in the 21st century. And I want to give a little example of how one of the ways I think we're dealing with it as a country, as a nation. And for Ralph Ellison, perhaps more profoundly than any other 20th century American novelist, the novel as a form is bound up with nationhood, specifically the nationhood of the United States of America. Here we are. We had a presidential election in 2008, and I think there was a sense on the part of some people, and they get all these funny terms bandied around, post-racial, whatever that means. I don't quite know what it means. But the sense that an African-American, the election of an African-American president was going to put really certain ghosts to rest. Well, it seems to me, I would say Barack Obama is an invisible man in this country. Because think about it. You say, well, it's question, people raise questions about whether he was born. Where's the birth certificate? What happened? Was it a spaceship or where? I mean, where did he come from? And then all kinds of other things about this man. Your new senator. I heard a clip. Your newly elected senator from the state of Massachusetts, you know, sneered at the woman who interviewed him, that is Senator Brown, and when they were talking about the problems of unwed mothers, problems of young women and children, and she, the interviewer said, well, Barack Obama's mother was 18, and he kind of laughed meanly. And she said, as if to suggest that she was an unwed mother. And the woman then said, she was married. And he said, well, maybe that. And then again, the sneer, okay? Now, there's a guy, it's one of 100, I guess we'd say these days. So it seems to me the vitriol, I'm not talking about political disagreements. I'm not talking about, you know, someone's disappointment in a leader, whatever side of the spectrum. I'm talking about the way in which this individual's humanity seems to me to be at stake, seems to me to be called into question. And I go back to that marvelous prose in the beginning of Invisible Man when Ellison, through Invisible Man, muses, broods on invisibility. What the hell has it come from? It's a matter of the construction. Gee, that's an interesting academic term, become an academic term. Nobody used it in 1952 except Ralph Ellison. We're used to social construction. What Ellison said, it's the whole question of invisibility is a matter of the construction of the inner eye of those who fail to see another person. So, in short, this book, Ellison's work, Invisible Man, incredibly, it's timely and timeless. It encompasses time and time stretching out. I wanted to say one other thing that I think has much to do with what Glenda and Adam have been talking about with respect to the second novel. Because we got to ask, at some point we have to say, no matter how much we love Ralph Ellison, love his work, we have to say, well, he didn't finish the book. 40 years, and he didn't finish the book. And unfortunately, I won't suggest that the biographer of Ralph Ellison has much in common with Scott Brown. I wouldn't never want to say that. But nevertheless, there are certain kinds of inferences in that biography of Arnold Rampersad's. You know, well, maybe he spent too much time, Ellison, that is, at the Century Club, you know. And maybe he was too much a kind of the white man's servant on various commissions and all of this kind of stuff. And the one, and you say, well, Adam, I wondered about this. You say, good God, man, there's box upon box upon box of the evidence in the Library of Congress. Go look at it. In other words, my sense is that so much of the difficulty of the second novel and its unfinished condition, and I would by no means want to suggest to you that if Ralph had another year, or two, or three, or four good years, he would have finished the book. I think it really became a fishbone in his throat. And you say, well, why? There are writerly issues involved that I think Adam and I are privy to, and Glenda was referring to them, and I hope we can talk about them. Writerly issues, and to some extent, issues that had to do with his material. And I want to read something to you. It's a letter that he wrote. He heard Adam talked about Brown v. Board. Ellison was reading. Well, he talks about it, so I just read his words here. This was the theme of his novel. Invisible Man is the Jim Crow novel, the novel of segregated America par excellence. And here the second novel is to be a novel of the evolving America post Brown v. Board. Think about that. Kind of complexity involved in that. Well, this is what Ellison wrote in a day or so after the Supreme Court decision came down, and he hears it on the radio. Well, now the court has found in our favor and recognized our human psychological complexity and citizenship, and another battle of the Civil War has been won. The rest is up to us, and I'm very glad. The decision came while I was reading A Stillness at Appomattox and A Study of the Negro Freedman, and it made a heightening of emotion and a telescoping of perspective, yes, and a sense of the problems that lie ahead that left me wet-eyed. I could see the whole road stretched out, and it got all mixed up with this book I am trying to write, and it left me twisted with joy and a sense of inadequacy. Why did I have to be a writer during a time when events sneer openly at your efforts, defying consciousness and form? Well, so now the judges have found, and Negroes must be individuals, and that is hopeful and good. What a wonderful world of possibilities are unfolded for the children. For me, there is still the problem of making meaning out of the past, and I guess I'm lucky I described Bledsoe before he was checked out. Now I'm writing about the evasion of identity, which is another characteristically American problem which must be about to change. Anyway, here's to integration, the only integration that counts, that of personality. Now, I want to follow that by reading two sentences from
then we have to
the
open
second
to
novel. Yeah, okay. Fair enough. Because, again, it seems to me one of the things going on here for 40 years with Ralph is every year that went by, Invisible Man grew in stature, and Ralph was, if anything, farther away from finishing this book. But what was he up to during all that time? Well, I'm going to just read a couple sentences, and I think they will give you a sense of how he imagined the complexities that he knew were coming in that letter he wrote in 1954. What I'm going to read you, I think written sometime probably in the late 1960s. So he's writing this in the late 1960s, mid to late 1960s. And yet the senator hallucinates this in 1954. And here are the sentences. Soon, the senator thought, it will come. They're beginning to stir. So as the old trainer said, watch their hands. And as old fighters, he warned, watch hands, feet, and head. Yes, they're moving into the open, and things are beginning to heave, and the backwash is beginning. But Hickman? Here? Unlikely. Though who knows who it was who came. And listen to this. 9 owls have squawked out the rules, and the hawks will talk. So soon they'll come marching out of the woodpile and the woodwork, sore head, sore foot, right up close, one butt shuffling into history, but demanding praise and kind treatment for deeds undone, for lessons unlearned, but studying war once more.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. Glenda was, I think, very kind. I was very happy that you mentioned that you brought up the issue of fathers and sons and the many ways they seem to work in relation to this novel. And people say, you know, well, what did Ralph think about this or that or the other in his work? And I just shake my head because, you know, I say, you know, that wasn't what our relationship was like. And Ralph Ellison didn't think about what was going to happen with it. He didn't appoint me literary executor. Mrs. Ellison wanted some help, asked me to help her. In the beginning, I helped her, and she asked me to be his literary executor. But anyway, you know, we didn't talk a hell of a lot about his work. But to answer your question, you bet. And Adam and I have also talked about this at great length. Ellison has a wonderful phrase about writing. He describes writing and the affect that writing produces in the writer. That same pain, that same pleasure. He got a lot of pleasure, even as he aged and wasn't closer to finishing the novel, but still writing new episodes. He got pleasure out of that, loved to play with words and language, unquestionably. It was also very painful, even possibly excruciating, that he wasn't finishing it. But he was private about it, quite private.
Yeah, I mean, this. Yes. There's a architecture to Ellison's novel that has with it a sense of the chronology of his composition. Particularly, we know that he gathered material together, revising it and shaping it into form at certain key moments. One time was in the 1970s in the typescripts that are here represented in Book 1 and Book 2. And we know because there are handwritten dates in which he says, I took it to Plainfield and worked on it at this particular moment. We also know in the work that I particularly focused on in editing this book with the computer material, we actually have a date that says, I composed it here, or at least I last saved it here. And we also see a certain pattern in which he's bringing the material together. Also, within the narrative itself, we see the reflection of time, often in kind of funny moments of anachronism. For instance, there's a scene in which Hickman, the jazz man turned preacher, is walking through Washington, D.C., and he sees a bunch of young guys sporting afros. It's 1955. I mean, I don't know. I probably not a lot of afros back then. Or there's a reference to the lunar landing as well. So, you know, this is amazing elasticity of the temporal frame of the book that was all in the purpose of doing what Ellison called achieving the aura of summing up in one of his interviews, the idea of trying to capture America for itself and for the world.
Yeah, just add one point again, because this is one of the things that Adam and Glenn have been talking about, the provisional quality of the book, and then you throw Juneteenth somewhere into the mix as you want, if you will, and there's a lot on your plate, on the reader's plate, to say, all right, how could this novel have been achieved? And Adam's talked about the aura of summing up, and I guess I get kind of wet-eyed at that one, because I don't think it's possible. I don't think the thing can be done. It has to be provisional, because the country's provisional. Ellison's theme is so provisional. So it seems to me that's both a wonderful comment that he let slip in a very considered way in 1984, during the interview with John Hersey. At the same time, it seems to me possibly akin to Sisyphus in a way.
Well, maybe we actually have to consider, too, one of the things, implicit questions the novel raises is the myth of the great author, right, and the myth of the great novel, and how much, as mm-hmm. powerful an artist as he was, and, you know, the comparison to Miles Davis was really apt, you know, how much are we actually limited as readers if we approach this whole project with thinking the second masterpiece by the great American writer in the great democracy of the world. It's like, what, all these superlatives, you know, it's like, okay, what if we try to focus on some other set of categories, right? How much are we being imprisoned by our own sense of what is high art, what is a great achievement, right?
I think Ellison would agree with you. In fact, I came across a note in which he talked about, he said, always remember that the sound of your machine inspires you to work, he said, something like that. So turn it on sometimes and just hit some keys and hear it. So I think he was very much in your tradition there.
And one quick thing in response, and which I think it complements what you were saying, Glenda. So many of the notes, so many of Ralph's notes that composed while he was writing are not the notes of some big puffed up character at all. They're saying, God, how the hell am I going to solve this problem? And he'll say, Ellison, you got to move the. He talks to himself. He says, Ellison, you got to move this thing. Action, plot, move it. So he's a very self-critical guy, I think, to a fault sometimes.
Yeah, and this is no, even a scholarship is, you know, there are Ellison men, right? Mm. And there are maybe 2-3 significant women critics, right? Hazel Corby, Horsten Spillers, right? But I'm fascinated by that, too, how it actually replicates the discussion.
Well, work.
Mm-hmm. You know, I wish somebody would write a book that looked at these. Oh, wait, I did write a book. I have a book coming out in May called Ralph Ellison in Progress that really, I think, dives into a lot of what you're saying. And I have a chapter in particular where I talk about these invisible women. And I'm speaking not only about the women, the female characters who are cut out of Invisible Man. We don't have time to talk about that today. But also about the characters that he crafts in the second novel, the women characters, and the place that Ellison gives to love in all of its forms in particular. And one of the forms is romantic love. That's something that, you know, Invisible Man is a pretty loveless book by design, I think. It was supposed to be the rugged individual, the single push for identity. And there wasn't a lot of space for those sorts of relationships. And yet in this novel, I think that's precisely what we see him exploring. I mean, this is a richness of connection between male and female characters, a richer rendering of female characters as well. Now, I don't know if that was in response so much to any sorts of developments in the literary realm. I think that was more in response to his own expanding vision, his own life, in which he had at least one very important woman in his life that constantly challenged him and really offered a fantastic model for a complex, multidimensional character. And his own expanding vision. I mean, Invisible Man, for all of its greatness, was a first novel. It was a novel that, even though it's a literary masterpiece, it was also, in some ways, a first attempt at finding a form. And he found a different form for the second novel, one that I think would embrace so much more along the lines of difference, race, gender, age, the whole thing.
2 points. And I'd like to let Ralph's words speak for him here. In 1954, the editors of the Paris Review had a long interview with Ellison, and much of it was taken up with Invisible Man. And one of the interviewers said something about, well, you know, and his love affairs, and Ellison said, he said, I'm glad you qualified, glad you went back on your statement, because don't you see, a guy like this isn't capable of a love affair. Now, he had women characters in earlier drafts of Invisible Man, but what I want to emphasize is that he deliberately, for reasons of utmost craft and theme, made the changes he made, because he was saying, Invisible Man, he is not yet a guy. I think Ellison would have said yet. He would have been hopeful. He's not yet a guy that's really able to love fully. Secondly, just to illustrate what Adam was talking about from the second novel, here's a passage that is in book two, and Hickman, an old man, has received a letter from a woman named Janie, and he hasn't seen her in decades, maybe 30 years, 40 years, I don't know. But she writes him a letter, trying to help the whole plot along. The senators are not blue, little bliss now, Adam's son Raiders, and there's some trouble brewing on the horizon. But what I want to read just Ellison's, this is Hickman's, it's written by Ellison, and it's Hickman's memory of this woman 40 years ago. And I think it will answer your question. It's one of Ralph's answers to your question. I think it's what Adam has in mind. He has a lot of other things in mind, too. I remember Janie from way back there in my heathen days, long before bliss came, riding out of the bottoms during that springtime flood on a dripping horse with 5 little children rode behind her and holding onto her nightgown and to each other while she swam that horse out of the swift water in her bare heels against his belly barrel till he came up to higher ground. Talking comfort to those children with weeds in her hair. Saved all of them, too. Walnut Grove, that was a woman. Oh, yes, she roused me then, too, up there looking, standing on the bank of mud and silt. Oh, yes, in that wet nightgown, she roused me.
And with that, I'd like to thank our... Thank you for coming.